This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Our speaker today is Dr. Noriko Solomon, who is professor in the Diagnostic Neuroradiology Department, director of the UCLA Clinical Image Processing Service, and director of the Diagnostic Neuroradiology Fellowship Program here at UCLA. She received her MD and PhD from Showa University in Tokyo, Japan, completed postgraduate residency and fellowship trainings in Japan, France, and at Northwestern University in Chicago. She joined the UCLA radiology faculty here in 2003 after completing a neuroradiology fellowship at UCLA. Dr. Solomon is known for what a fantastic teacher she is because she has a long list of awards from residents and fellows, including the Leo Rigler Outstanding Teaching Award in 2011 and a Cum Laude Award and a Certificate of Merit from the Radiological Society of North America in 2011. She also won the Women in Neuroradiology Leadership Award from the American College of Radiology, American Society of Neuroradiology, and American Association for Women Radiologists. Her work is funded by multiple grants from the National Institutes of Health, and she has a team of individuals working collaboratively on many of these projects. She has published some 100-plus peer-reviewed articles and has been a frequent invited speaker at various venues. We clinicians are very happy when we know that Dr. Noriko, as we call her, has interpreted a neuroradiological investigation. So the title of her talk today is Neuroimaging of Pediatric Disease. Dr. Solomon.
Thank you for your very kind, generous, and kind introduction. So I'm very happy to be here. I made a subtitle that's something you want to know but afraid to ask. This is something I plan to talk about today, that simple question you have. And I have many things I want to know and then I want to ask to the pediatric people. So I hope some of these talks can answer your question. So the outline of this lecture today is, first of all, the imaging modality. We have many imaging modalities now, and mainly MRI and CT I'm focusing to talk about, and what is the pros and cons of MRI or CT. And you can see that CT, if you order CT for the pediatric patient, you have to think about the radiation risk. So I'm talk about a little bit about how we can handle those risks. And when you are getting MRI is a longer study, so you need a sedation. So I will just touch base about some of those informations. And then I try to show you the basic approach to identify pediatric disease. The most important thing for the pediatric central nervous system, especially for the brain, is to understand the myelination and development of the brain, because that makes the imaging features different from the adult. And the disease process also makes sense if you know the development of the brain and stages. Especially for the terminal zone of myelination I'm talk about later, is being interpreted as a abnormality. So many people may overcall, or you may overcalling when you're looking at the MRI, for example. And then I'm going to show some clinical cases with modern imaging techniques for example, developmental delay with using diffusion tensor imaging, which is some cool white matter tracking, and hypoxic encephalopathy, and you want to see the how the brain outcome gonna be. We use MR spectroscopy, and so I'm show you how to interpret it, MR spectroscopy, and then give some more examples of, say, non-accidental trauma infections. So first, the modality of choice, CT and MRI, pros and cons are pretty clear. The CT is very rapid. When I started radiology, CT took maybe 20 minutes to do in and out, or you have to sit for a long time to imaging to come out. But nowadays we use spiral CTs, and then modern technique has been developed significantly, so we can do a in and out in within a couple of minutes. So this is really advantageous for the children. And the CT is very good at still define acute hemorrhage or skull fractures. So this is also very advantageous for the pediatric trauma or, you know, simple disease for the pediatric population. However, CT has, you also have to think about the radiation, and the CT may miss several disease. The MRI, so the everything bad about CT, MRI can cover, so there's no radiation and better resolution, and then you can use a modern technique to see something you can't see in CT scan. However, it takes a longer time, so I don't know if you have had MRI by yourself, but there are long kind of hole you have to lie down in a very small place, and there is a loud noise, so it's not really comfortable. It takes at least 30 minutes. So for the kids to stay still, 30 minutes is almost impossible. So may need a sedation. Right, so those are the pros and cons in general. Well, to be able to reduce the risk of the radiation, in general, we all use low-dose CT. So the radiation dose in general will be affected by tube voltage of the CAT scan and the tube current time product, which we call milliampere second mass, and how frequently patient gets scanned. More frequently scanned, that's going to be more radiation to the patient, of course. And size thickness, if the stress thickness is thinner, you can get more radiation. And number of sections, larger sections, can get more radiation. And also the pitch is the how fast the table moves. So if you have a fast-moving table, then you can get less radiation because the exam time is faster. But you can imagine that very fast-moving stuff is you just taking a picture in the car or something, so you can have a less resolution. So nowadays, these CT vendors are trying to make faster but better resolution to develop the technology is focused on those areas, and then eventually the reason doing this is to reduce also the radiation dose. And the most common cause of larger radiation is this tube current time product is high, and then patient get frequent scans. When we use a thin slice thickness scans is the when you order a skull abnormality like cranial synostosis, and then you want to see the nice pictures of the 3D rendering like this, then you have a very thin slice thickness for entire brain, so that's going to be a lot of radiation. So we use a low-dose CT to only focusing on the bone. So when you order this type of CT scan for the skull, you don't have much information for the brain. you may think this is all scan, so you can see all the informations, but we use raw dose to sacrifice all the others. So patient is not getting much of radiation dose, but we don't see the enough information for everything. Temporal bone CT is the same thing. You can see the temporal bone malformation can be seen by this CT very well, and this is less than 1 millimeter size thickness, so you have a lot of radiation here. Again, we're going to use a specific protocol to decrease the dose. So many of these synthesized scans are well controlled by radiation standard. So here's the example of low-dose CT. So if you look at this images on the left side, this is the 220 mass, which usually we use for the adult. And then if you deduce this to 80, so 1.6 millisievert, this is the sievert, is how much the body is getting into absorbed radiation. You can reduce for significant amount to 0.58 millisievert. But if you look carefully, it's a little bit grainy. So compared to this, you can see the pixels. So that's why if you're looking for some very subtle findings, you may miss. But if you want to just look at the ventricular sides, that'll be good enough to evaluate. If you're looking for the hemorrhage, this is good enough. And this 0.58 millisievert is maybe doesn't mean nothing to you, but this is about the same dose as scar X-ray. So you see the scar X-ray or CT, you always pick scar X-ray because it's easy to do, faster, and then less radiation. But we can do as a similar dose, low dose of a study, using a low-dose CT scan. So this is something I want you to aware. Well, when you do MRI scan, we always need a sedation. And then the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends the infants should take nothing by mouth for at least 4 hours before deep sedation, etc. So if you are thinking about MRI, you have to think of age of the patient, how the kid behaves. It depends on the kids. Say, 10-year-old, maybe, you know, need a sedation, but it depends on how the 10-year-old is, right? So you have to know, and then if you need a sedation, don't take anything by mouth, and then have to be monitored, so there is a specific arrangement be needed. So especially for the babies, that's going to be a big stress, and then for the parents as well. So one of the way to many children hospital dealing with the baby sedation is MR-compatible incubator. So this incubator is MR-compatible, so you can place the baby, feed the baby, bundle up, and then place it. You already have a coil inside. So baby can sleep within, and then temperature is well controlled. So you can prepare everything in the bedside and then put it in the cart like this, and then just rise into the MRI scanner. So then baby is in the same environment, and then maybe sleeping, and then so you don't have to worry about the sedation. Then baby may wake up, but you can get some of the studies without sedation. So this is one of the solution that doing without sedation. Of course, this is not cheap, but I think, you know, one of the things many children hospitals have those. Now, looking at the brain, just surface rendering imaging here, between 23 weeks baby brain to 34 to 40 weeks, you can see the significant difference in anatomy. So that's why the preemie versus term baby may have a completely different anatomy and functional basic. So if you are looking for same stroke, even the stroke is small, that's going to be a different outcome for those babies' brain. So it's everything happens between 20 to 30 weeks. You can see the sulcation is almost none to almost adult postpartum sulcation. So if you look at the maturation in axial plane, here's a 24 weeks, almost you don't see nothing, but you can see lots of induration and indentation. And then those indentation will also accentuating the maturation and the organization of the brain connectivities as well. So the myelination of the white matter is you can observe by MRI, and basically it's inferior to superior, they're happening posterior to anterior and central to peripheral. This is a basic, and then matures by 2 year old. So before 2 year old, the baby brain is very variable and different. So it looks really different. So that's how people may confuse, and then everything looks abnormal. In general, when you're looking for the brain abnormality, either brain tumor or infarction or infection, when tissue damage happens, it's going to be in hyper-intense in T2 and hypo-intense in T1 because you can contain more water into the tissue. Well, the baby brain already contains lots of water, so this water signal may not be visible. And then everything looks more abnormal than usual. So here is the birth to 9 months. You can see if you look at the concentrated and central portion is very bright at first and then it's getting darker. So that's how the central portion starts myelinating first. And then if you compare to posterior to anterior, you can see the posterior portion is much darker than anterior portion. So that's how grossly you can observe. And the myelination is already happened at birth. So if you look at this fetal myelination staining, you see the cerebellum and the brainstem, white matter fibers, already formed and myelinated, but nothing in the supratentorial. The only areas that you can see is the central sulcus regions, so the motor cortex areas, the fibers already there. But if you look at the baby can talk at birth, of course, but they are moving extremities so that motor things are already connected. The imaging-wise, the T1 weighted imaging changes before T2 weighted imaging and matures by 8 months, and then T2 weighted imaging matures by 2 years old. So I think everything before 2 years old, the things are all different. So here's a T1 weighted imaging goes 3 months, 6 months. T2 weighted imaging, 3 months, 6 months. And then 15 months, 22 months. If you look at the 15 months old of baby, T1 and T2, it almost looks like an adult brain. But if you look here, it looks really abnormal or different from the adult brain. Then eventually, if you look at the newborn and 2 year old, which is adult pattern, so the white matter, this yellow arrow, is more contains water, so whiter in T2 and darker in T1, which is going to reverse once these things are myelinated. So that's why if you are looking for something, disease process, which is brighter in T2 and darker in T1, it's easy to find out in dark background in bright signal, well, white background in dark signal, but it's going to be very difficult to find out in this situation. So if you have a case like this, these are two different babies, and then one side is smaller than the others. So which side is abnormal? This is abnormal side, or this is abnormal side, or this is abnormal, or this is abnormal side. It will be hard to say sometimes. You have to know what the age of the patient. So this baby is 3 months old. Then you have to know what the normal 3 months old look like. So here's a normal 3 months old look like. So if you look at the 3 months old, supposed to be look like this, then this looks too dark in the white matter. This also too dark in the white matter. So that's why this side is abnormal in this case, and this side is abnormal in this case. So this baby, the abnormal side is the atrophic side. This baby, abnormal side is the hypertrophic side. And this is a 3 months old with left-sided hemimegaloencephaly, and this side is 3 months old with right-sided Sturge-Weber syndrome with entire atrophy. Why this is so dark in both sides? And these two disease processes, Sturge-Weber and hemimegaloencephaly, they have a more hypermyelination happens. So if you have a hypermyelination, 3 months old look like this, and then nothing myelinates, but this abnormal side is more myelinated, so that's why it looks darker. So you have to know what's the normal brain look like, and then you have to know the disease process, either causing atrophy is abnormal or hypertrophy is abnormal. And then it's, each disease has either more causing hypomyelination or hypermyelination. And then if you are looking at this 15 months to much older age, you have a brain kind of myelinated through, but there are areas of, especially for the posterior periventricular white matter, it's not really myelinating as the other area. This is called terminal zone of myelination. This area will be myelinated at the end, very late stage. So that's why if you look at this stage, this looks abnormal. This looks like a periventricular high intensity. Is this PVL? Is this some kind of leukodystrophy? So the baby comes with developmental delay and then have this. Everybody wants to call this something abnormal. And then the long list of genetic testing or some other stuff can start off. And then that's going to be, sometimes it's going to be a problem. So say this is 11 months old. Compared to the normal 15 months old, they are high intensity. So is this the terminal zone of myelination? Well, this is eventually a metachromatic leukodystrophy kid. Well, how do you know that? Of course, if you follow up in 7 months later, usually this is going to fade away because if you look at this, anterior white matter is developing. So if the white matter is continue developing, this is going to fade away, but it's still there as abnormal. So this is something abnormal. But also, if you can see the dark line between ventricle and this high intensity, that is normal. That is the terminal zone of myelination. The most of the disease process causing periventricular high intensity, you have a continuum high intensity reaches to the ventricular surface. So those little things is very helpful. And then you may not overcalling everybody like this on terminal zone myelination as possible metachromatic leukodystrophy. So this is a terminal zone, and this is a case of adrenal leukodystrophy. The early phase of adrenal leukodystrophy versus metachromatic leukodystrophy or any dystrophy can be difficult to differentiate, but you can differentiate with between terminal zone of myelination, which is completely normal kids, versus the other dystrophy. So those are the some tips for myelinations. And the, now I'm going to talk about some application for some modern techniques. So application for diffusion tensor imaging. Diffusion tensor imaging is a water molecule intensity, one of the brain sequences you can looking for specific white matter water molecule movement. And well, DWI, which we use for stroke, is the some simple portion of the diffusion tensor imaging. So DWI takes about a one minute or less than one minute. And diffusion tensor imaging may take 5 minutes. But this can identify very subtle changes which you may not see in conventional brain imaging. And if I say that, everybody gonna jump on and, oh, I need a DTI for everything. Well, which eventually everybody is doing right now for the research. So, you know, developmental delay, baby, which you find something that's maybe helpful, but you look at MRI with the brain and looks relatively normal, then you can't really explain why this baby is not developing well. Or PVL, how badly affected the white matter can explain, or you can predict the outcome of the baby. That'll be helpful, and DTI can be play one role to evaluating those developmental delays. Traumatic brain injury is a big one. Traumatic brain injury, if you have a big hemorrhage or encephalomalacia, maybe that can explain the seizure or developmental problem or cognitive changes. But if you have a very minor traumatic changes or concussion and still have some clinical findings, people have problem explaining those, and then they are maybe trying to rely on too much of any technique which may find something. Psychiatric disease, autism, ADHD, OCD has a big research on using DTI. And then we have lots of congenital heart disease patients here at UCLA, and congenital heart disease people also have some brain malformation or brain disease, not only stroke, but some developmental problem. And then these may not be seen by conventional MRI, and then DTI may find those changes, which has lots of research going on. And then DTI can, because they can trace the white matter tracking, so this is a good pre-surgical guide to preserve white matter pathway. So, for example, this is a 14-year-old patient had a developmental delay. He may had a preemie, so he has a large ventricle, but just looking at this, very symmetrical, doesn't have big holes in the brain or anything, so looks okay. But this is the normal 14-year-old should look like. So if you look at this to this, of course, ventricles are bigger, but if you look at this, white matter fibers are very thick and rich, you don't have much for this baby. So compared to normal 14-year-old has a significant volume loss of the white matter. But these kind of changes may not be much appreciated as it looks. So using a diffusion tensor imaging, so this is one of the way to visualize the white matter. So you can see the lots of colors. The red colors are the white matter going right to left, left to right. So the corpus callosum goes to right to left to right, so it's red. And optic radiation is going anteroposterior, so this is green. So anteroposterior fibers are green, and up and down fibers are blue. So corticospinal tract is blue, for example. So you can see the different direction of the fibers in different colors. So, and also you can see the thickness and more intensity of the color get more obvious if the baby grow. So 3 months to 4 year old, you can see the better color and then thicker color configuration in those. So if you do this 14-year-old, your DTI, this is what you get from this baby. So, and then if you compare to this and then measure the each fiber, how integrity of the white matter fibers are, then this is very similar to 3 months old. So that's a significant information that you can get. And then its brain is big enough, ventricles are big and white matter is small, but if you quantify, then that's really get significant delay may explain white matter is not really growing. This is the other tractography for neurosurgeons, for example, if you have a big mass and then near the pyramidal tract, and so the pyramidal tract is invaded So you can really separate, or the mass is just pushing the pyramidal tract, and then you can delineate, you can just take the tumor out without harming much the pyramidal tract. So those are the good informations, easy informations neurosurgeon can use, and DTIs are very good at doing this. So here's an example of normal brain. So brain looks pretty normal. And then if you do a diffusion tensor imaging and then and some statistical analysis, then you can see there's some area of frontal white matter has disturbance of the white matter bundles. And then you can kind of visualize, yeah, these fibers are a little bit sparse, or maybe there are some axonal injury happened in those areas. And then once you show this, everybody is jump out, well, this brain is normal, maybe DTI can find something. So that's going to be a big problem right now. And recently in NFL and football and hockey league, have lots of traumatic injury or concussion, and they are making a big deal about medical legal implication of personal injury litigations, and then DTI is always playing too much role in those. As a medical, profession, DTI, you have to know that DTI is very sensitive but not specific. So when we scan all of us to a DTI, we may find something statistically abnormal. What does it mean? Well, if you function well, that's not the problem. But if you're really seeking for something to explain, you can just try on this to explain for these statistical changes. And there's substantial overlap between normal code and mild traumatic injury or mild everything. So if you do DTI, it's very sensitive study, so you always find something, you may find something, but what does it mean is it's a big question. So that's what we have to know. Now, moving on to the spectroscopy. Spectroscopy is looking for specific metabolite increase or loss in the brain. So for example, HIE case has NAA is one of the metabolites, is low, and then lactate can be visible, or lipid can be visible. So this is the showing if this tissue is going to die or this tissue is still okay. MELAS or some mitochondrial disease can have you can pick up lactate peak. So this helps the diagnosis. The metabolic disease like Canavan disease have the accumulation of N-acetyl aspartate. So you can see that this high NAA peak, for example. But otherwise, again, spectroscopy is very non-specific. So everything in the brain disease have a low NAA and high choline. So you can't really say because of the pattern, this is it. So this is a spectroscopy look like. If you want to have a spectroscopy, you have to place the voxel. You can have a single voxel, multi-voxel, and you can just run the MRI scan. So every voxel takes, say, 3 to 4 minutes. It's not like you got the MRI and you can just place a voxel later on and then you can just calculate. You have to scan it within the voxel, right? And then you can get these peaks. So NAA, N-acetyl aspartate is a neuronal axonal marker. So all disease affecting neurons or axons, right? MS, stroke, neoplasm, infection, HIE, everything gonna go down, right? And choline is a membrane turnover ratio. So if you have some inflammation or something brain is reacting, then choline gonna go up. If you have a neoplasm really destroying the stuff, choline gonna be very high. Some inflammation, it's a little bit high. So degree of the peak of the choline can indicate how much membrane turnover ratio is going on. Lactate is anaerobic metabolism, And lipids are necrosis. So if you have a very high lipid lactate peak, these are the kind of dying tissues. So those are the interpretation of metabolites. And the one thing you have to remind again is the myelination. So we said myelination can be up to adult pattern by 2 years old. Well, spectroscopy can follow the same rule. So if you look at the newborn of spectroscopy, newborn neuron doesn't, or axons, not much there, right? So within the brain tissue, you have not much NAA. And then, but they are working very hard to create the myelination, so choline is extremely high. So if you look at the newborn spectroscopy, it looks abnormal because choline is high and NAA is low, but that's the normal pattern. And then this became NAA and choline became a little bit same height by 4 months old. And then by 2 year old, NAA is higher than choline, it became an adult pattern. So those are the things you, again, these, if you know the development of the child, of in general, the myelination in the brain, you know, those all make sense. So here's an example how we use it routinely. Is this is a two-day-old baby with respiratory distress at home and then didn't breathe, and the mother brought to the hospital. So he's a two-day-old, and then get the CT scan. Well, do you see anything abnormal? That's always difficult to see in a baby brain in CT, right? Because baby brain is already have lots of water, so it looks dark. Well, so here is the normal two-day-old brain look like. Well, if you compare, is there anything different? Maybe not, but you see, usually what I use is centrally white matter is always dark, but if you look at the peripherally, you always see something brighter. You see, so this is brighter, 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 and then central is dark, right? Grossly. And then if you see this, you don't see any bright signal, bright density. So that looks abnormal. And then, you know, suggest for brain edema, maybe. I don't know if it is entire brain edema or partial brain edema, and then get the MRI. So this is MRI 4 days later. So, well, again, this is a six-day-old MRI look like. So if you compare, if you have a comparison, that's easy. But here is a gray matter, it's dark line, and then white matter is white in T2-weighted imaging here. So this looks okay, this area. But if you go here, is you don't see a dark line like this in the gray matter. So maybe this half posterior is abnormal, right? So did a spectroscopy to see if this tissue is recover or die. So one box cell in the frontal, the other box cell in more posterior. Okay, so then if you look, this is 6 days old, so the choline is still higher than NAA, but you can see you have a very little lactate peak and lipid peak, but it's much lower than NAA. So you have maintained neurons and axons in this box cell. Okay, this one is you have a large lactate and lipid peak. So this means this tissue is going to necrose. Right? And then if you look at this shape of the NAA peak, have a little shoulder here. This is a glutamine-glutamate peak. So this is a normal glutamine-glutamate peak. This is a very high glutamine-glutamate peak. Glutamine-glutamate can be increased when the tissue is dying. And then pushes NAA peak here. So real NAA height is from here to here. So NAA is extremely low, high lactate peak. So this tissue we're going to die. So that's what I'm going to say in the report. And then we'll see how it happens. And then this is 18 days later. So you can see these tissues in the posterior portion has necrosis, and the frontal lobe looks okay. This baby recently came back. This is now 4 years old, severely delayed. But if you look here, is frontal portion is myelinated, right? But disproportionately, posterior portion never did anything. So you don't have a normal white matter. And then it's not look bad if you just don't know this history, but eventually he's blind, and then you don't see any development, normal development of the occipital lobe, for example. So those are the things spectroscopy can be used to say if this sample tissue has a good outcome or not. The other implication is if you see some bilateral disease, this is a basal ganglia, it's hyper intense here. This is subacute necrotizing encephalomyelopathy or Leigh disease. And Leigh disease have a very high lactate. And then you can just sample the lactate peak using MR spectroscopy. So these basal ganglia, bilateral basal ganglia signal density abnormality is have a long list of differential, but if you have a high lactate peak, you can just focus on certain disease. Here is an example of Canavan disease. Canavan disease have a characteristic MRI findings, but there are some other vanishing white matter disease, etc., can look the same. So do a spectroscopy and sample this white matter, then you have a very high NAA peak. NAA should be at most twice higher than creatine, and then this is too high. So that's too much accumulation in the white matter. So those are the things you can use for make a diagnosis. So in general, how I read MRI is you just look at the T1 sagittal in the brain and then make sure all the structures are there. So cerebellum, posterior fossa, brainstem, and corpus callosum, and pituitary gland. And then if you see the, you don't see the corpus callosum, this is a corpus callosum agenesis. And you can do the tractography to see, you don't see any red fibers, that means there is no corpus callosum. And if you have a big cyst in the posterior fossa compared to the normal, this is the Ndiwoka malformation. If you see the small posterior fossa with a herniating thing, then that's Chiari 1. Chiari 2 is more a severe malformation with not only the cerebellum, the medulla is also down, and the also associated malformation of the corpus callosum agenesis, dysgenesis as well. Chiari type 3 is Chiari 2 plus encephalocele, so you have a big defect, and then the brain tissue, either cerebellum or occipital lobe, come out from that hole. So those are the easy malformations we can just looking at the sagittal, make a diagnosis. In terms of the tonsillar descent, looking at the sagittal imaging, we often say cerebellar tonsils are descended, or and then people want to call Chiari malformation. For the kids, if you draw a line, option and Bayesian here, and then if you see this tip of the cerebellar tonsils, if below this line, child can be normal up to 6 millimeters because you have a brain and then skull is very incorporated and then brain is growing. So you're going to have a little bit more descent, which is normal. So if you see the less than 5 millimeter of descent and then in 15-year-old, up to 15-year-old, that's normal. So important thing is if you have a pointed appearance of descent like this, that's abnormal. But if you have a round shape of descent like this, that may not be any clinical implications. So that's also the other things people overcall. If you always want to measure, and then especially for the kids, if you have a, like 3 millimeters, 4 millimeters, you say some people call this as Chiari malformation, which may not be true. In axials, so you can see that this is a T1 weighted imaging because ventricle is dark, and here's a T2 weighted imaging, and then see how the sulcation is look like. So the gray matter is very thin, like this, like about 2 millimeters, and then make sure there is asymmetric configurations. So if you look at here, this is normal, and then this is a leukodystrophy. It's easy to see because white matter is all abnormal, right? And then, but this is a little bit tricky because if you look at the, if you don't have a normal, this almost looks normal with just a big ventricle. But eventually, if you look at this gray matter, it's much thicker. And then the insula is not covered. You see the insula here, and then always have an extra tissue to cover the insula, and the insula is open. So if you see those are the polymicrogyria, and this kid has a microcephaly and developmental delay, and then he has a diffuse polymicrogyria, for example. This is a T1 with imaging, normal, and then here is a eventually, there's a cleft, so this is open lip schizencephaly and then associated polymicrogyria here. This is a normal ventricle look like. If you look at this ventricle, it's big, but also you don't have a septum. You have to see this septation between two ventricles normally. If you don't see this, this is a septum pellucidum, agency of septum pellucidum. And then you have to look for some other disease, and then you can see this person has a subependymal heterotopia right here. So those are the basic stuff, you know. Ideally, always have a normal next to it and then compare, but do this. I just, to finish, try to show you the example of CT versus MRI, which is how the CT is helpful, how the MRI is helpful. CT is better in usual the trauma or sinusitis, looking for calcification and hemorrhage, and MRI is everything else. So important thing is when the patient is having a trauma, CT is good. But if it is suspicion of non-accidental trauma, you may have to get the MRI. So non-accidental trauma, what to look for is a subdural hematoma, skull fracture, multiple skull fractures. Retinal hemorrhage we don't see. It's rarely seen, so it's clinical. And the brain edema and infarctions, those are hard to see in CTs, or you have to have wait for the later stage. So you have to get the MRI if you have a suspicion or baby is too sick as small subdural hematoma. So the imaging modality for non-accidental trauma is CT has to be the initial thing because it's faster. But you have to also understand CT misses cytotoxic edema or something more substantially, severely injured brain parenchyma. So if you want to look at the brain parenchyma, you have to do the MRI study. And then diffusion-weighted imaging is very helpful to define the extensive brain damage. So So the other thing is non-accidental trauma is when the hemorrhage happened. That's always police asks, right? So when you see the hemorrhage, the hyperdense hemorrhage is like few hours to 7 to 10 days. And then if it is really hyperacute in less than 3 hours, you may not see as a extreme high density. If the baby is anemic, you may not see high density at all, because you need to have some hematocrit to become a hyperdense in CT scan. Subacute phase 2 to 3 weeks, that's going to be isodense, and then become hypodense after 3 weeks. So this is very vague and in broader stage of dating. And then you may think MRI can help. Well, MRI is much more ambiguous. And MRI, there's a lots of, this is very busy, right? But if the hemorrhage, if you're looking at the hemorrhage in subdural space, T1 is low and T2 is low, then this is less than 3 days. That's, you can tell. But less than 3 days, usually you can see the high density in CT. And when the T1 become high and still T2 low, that's going to be 7 days to 2 weeks. When the T2 is high and T1 is high, then this is 2 weeks to 2 months. You can't really tell when it happens. 2 weeks to 2 months is just too vague as an investigation. So, but those are the basic, people ask me always, can you date the hemorrhage? Well, my answer is this. you know, this is it's not that easy. The other thing is we're always looking for the different stage of hemorrhages, right? So when the admission, you have hemorrhage here, but these hemorrhages can redistribute if you are sitting on the bed. So the 16 hours later, this same blood may go to here. So it's not a new hemorrhage. This is not two separate hemorrhage. This is going to be the redistribution of the hemorrhage. The other important thing is the benign hygroma of infancy. Again, up to 2 years old, brain is keep growing. The brain is keep myelinating. So up to 2 years old, you can have some discrepancy of skull size and brain size, right? So skull can grow faster than brain. So you can have a space, right? And then, so when you have a space, is this subdural hematoma or hygroma that patient being abused, or this is just a benign thing? Well, you have to look at the vein. If it is subdural, vein is displaced towards the brain parenchyma. If it's benign one, vein is just floating or in the near the skull. So this is a very important thing, and many people read this as a subdural and then, you know, have a false accusation for the accidental trauma, non-accidental trauma, for example. This is the shaken baby. This is how the DWI is helpful. So he has a very small subdural hematoma, but also central. So if you see the subdural hematoma in the central portion, you have to think a little bit suspicious because this is an unusual place to have a subdural hematoma. But otherwise, brain looks fine. But if you do DWI, you have all the cortex has been injured. So this is called black brain and then big edema. So these may not be visible, either CT or conventional MRI. So that's why the DWI is very important. So that's why the baby is not waking up, for example. Here's the other example, completely different, but CT can help, or this is important things that you have to pay attention to. Many kids have sinus disease. And, you know, well, sinusitis, and then you can just give antibiotics and go home. But when you see a CT and then you have a bone breakage, then you have to get the either contrast CT or MRI because this is the dural extension, intraparenchyma extension of the infection. So that can create a brain abscess, and then that's going to be a big, you know, clinical outcome be devastating. This is one case we often miss, brainstem tumor, patient vomiting and then, or having hydrocephalus. Then you have to get the MRI because this is the where you're supposed to see the brainstem tumor, but it's you can't really say if this is abnormal or not. But if you do MRI, you can see this is very obviously abnormal. So how easy this is to get MRI to solve the problem, for example. Hydrocephalus kid, the third and lateral ventricles enlarged, the fourth is not enlarged, so probably between third and fourth, that's where the obstruction is. Those are very difficult to define by CT scan, but MRI can. So you can see the little web at the aqueduct. So then you can just make a diagnosis why this person has a hydrocephalus. The patient has confusion, CT looks normal, and then this is eventually a cryptococcus. So those are the subtle changes you may not see in CT, and then only MRI can see. So the parenchymal disease, you always have to get the MRI. And then if you have this type of abscess, DWI can help you because if you have a sticky fluid within the cavity, DWI can pick up as a restricted diffusion, meaning sticky fluid, it doesn't really play like a freely moving water in the CSF. So this water and this water will be very different in consistency. So that's you can use DWI again to make a diagnosis of abscess. The meningitis, this is a TB meningitis, also CT may only show as a hydrocephalus. this is the another example of TB. This patient has a significant granulomatous disease. The CT with contrast doesn't really show much, but if you do MRI, you can see much better. That's really significant. This is a patient with a confusion and they have a stroke. And then you can see the MRI better, but also if you see something very suspicious with lots of enhancement, you have to think this as also infectious process and do a MRA. So the vascular imaging I didn't talk about much, but MRA is do a great job to looking for stroke, occlusion, and then some of the vasculopathy. So this is a TB causing vascular occlusion here, but you can see the occlusion of the vessels nicely. So if you are looking for vasculitis or small vessel inflammation, you have to do conventional angiogram, but conventional angiogram is very invasive. MRA can play a very important role to evaluating most of the vessels. Then the CT can help calcification, such as tuberous sclerosis, subventral nodules can calcify here. And then this is the Sturge Weber case, but you can see the calcification amazingly by MRI. See, but it's too easy to see a calcification by CT. So those are the quick review for something you want to know. And then I think I just gave you some of my secrets. So, you know, CT for trauma, calcification and hemorrhage, MRI for parenchymal disease, that's a basic thing. You have to know we are available for all those CTs, so don't worry about much. And then the myelination, the baby's brain is not normal up to 2 years old. So you saw many examples of 2 years old are cut, and then up to this, you have to be very careful. And then we have to know the advantage and limitation of the DTI and spectroscopy. I have some references for the radiation dose. I can give you this presentation. And thank you very much for your attention.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.